This is Legalese, where the law is always on your side. Now introducing your host, a longtime veteran of the courts, Dennis Willinchek.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chester Chet Reynolds, in our booth there. And
this you can just call me Hans, and I'll be good with that.
I purposely didn't. Anyway, I'm all wired up here and trying to untangle the cord, but we're pleased to be with you, as we are every week, talking about all issues relating to our state. And this week, we're pleased to have on Bill Montgomery, who is our county attorney, and now newly elected county attorney for, I guess, what would you say, Bill, the second time, or how does that work?
Well, I've been phrasing it as I've been elected in my first full four-year term.
Oh, okay, good. That's a better way to say it. I agree. And so most of you know that Bill fulfilled the term of Andrew Thomas that was vacant and defeated Rick Romley, former county attorney, which was a great victory for him. And then this time almost ran unopposed. Nobody wanted to run against him because he's doing a great job. But anyway, Bill has been on the show a long time ago, but lots has happened since then and since the show really started some time ago. Bill, by way of introduction, is our county attorney, as I said, is a graduate of West Point Military Academy, was awarded the Bronze Star for meritorious service during Desert Storm, and I think everybody's now very sensitive to that fact that people serve our country like that. And I'm going to follow up a quick story, Bill, with that after I introduce you. And anyway, following Bill's military service, he earned his Juris Doctorate from ASU Law School, graduating magna cum laude. He's a former deputy county attorney and was elected the Maricopa County Attorney in 2010, as I said earlier. And Bill resides in Gilbert with his family, and we're pleased to have you on the show again.
Thank you.
This time live.
Yes.
You made your way here, and we appreciate that. I want to say I was watching TV before I left the house this morning, and they had on a little segment I caught as I was walking out with Drew Brees, you know, the New Orleans Saints quarterback.
Right.
Anyway, he was actually tearing up telling a story about how he had gone over to Europe I believe it was Asia. His grandfather had served in the military in the invasion, I guess it was, of Okinawa. And again, I heard this very quickly, but what I heard of it, he basically teared up and said that he just couldn't believe. He said every time he thinks about it, just, you know, he gets a knot in his throat, how his grandfather, 19 years old, went over there in an invasion like that, and he called his grandfather up one day and said, gee, I can't even imagine doing what you did, you know, when I was 19 years old. What were you thinking over there, you know? And his grandfather said, well, I'll tell you the truth, most of the time I was just thinking about making it to 20, you know?
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you would probably know better than I would that feeling, right? I mean,
yeah, for the most part, you know, nobody joins up for the service expecting or anticipating all the parades and all the accolades that if you go to war, well, not for all of us, but for some, it can follow.
Or conversely, conversely, in my generation, when you came back home from Vietnam, you got spit on pretty much. So
right.
The opposite of that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so day to day, week to week, month to month, it simply is just doing the job that's in front of you.
Right.
And when I deployed for Desert Shield and Desert Storm, now, there were no thoughts of, gosh, isn't this glorious? Aren't we all doing wonderful stuff? No, it was, okay, what do I need to do today for me as a tank platoon leader so that all 15 of my soldiers are alive tomorrow and eventually all of them go home to their families? Yeah. And that's just really what's in front of
sure.
you is what do I need to do for the next 24 hours to be where I need to be doing what right. I need to do?
Right, yeah. Tremendous responsibility, and we can't thank you enough, honestly, for your service over there and what you did. You know, while we're on that, actually, it occurred to me to ask you how some of that is translated into where you are today in terms of leadership skills and what you learned in that. I mean, I think some of it is obvious, as you just said, but are there other examples that you can give me of things that you learned over there that you employ really heading up a huge office that you do?
Oh, absolutely. The first important lesson I learned as a leader, and I was 22, 23 years old at the time, and half of my tank platoon, they were older than me.
Yeah.
But I was still responsible for them. And one of the first principles of leadership that I remember learning as a cadet at West Point is that you look out for your people and you take care of their well-being. And then in supervising soldiers and making sure that they can be successful is creating an environment in which they can do the job that they need to do and make sure that they have the resources to do it. Those are the same basic things that I do now as the county attorney.
Mm.
Sure, a much larger office than a tank platoon. We've got over 900 total folks
yeah.
up and down the line who work there. But it's the same thing. look out for the folks who work there, take care of their well-being, and make sure that they've got what they need in order to do the job that, we who live in Maricopa County expect them to do every day. And you create that kind of an environment and then just let people do the job that they want to do. Morale improves, work product improves, and I've seen it at every single level of leadership that I've had the privilege to operate at, whether formally or informally, with those being the very basic principles to employ, I've been able to see people enjoy great success.
Well, that brings up another question, which is how much do you micromanage a huge office like that? I mean, you can't possibly, it seems to me, know all of what's going on there. So you can't possibly get into the details like when this was a small county, and so you have to really just put good people in place and hope that they do the job that you give them the power to do.
Exactly. And there's another lesson learned, too, from when I was in the Army, because the last assignment I had, I commanded an armored cavalry troop. Well, part of the responsibility for that assignment was basically to control 6 miles of earth and know everything that went on within that 6 miles. But there's no way that you can be everywhere. So you've got to train subordinate leaders to go out and do the mission that you're entrusting them to do, and then make sure that they've got the tools to be able to do it. Well, the same thing as you were mentioning earlier. I can't know every single case.
No.
We had over 30,000 felonies last year.
Right.
So what my responsibility then is to be held accountable by the voters and the people of Maricopa County is to make sure that I put in place a management team that will operate consistent with what my prosecution philosophies are. And then because of what I said earlier about looking out and taking care of people, they also have to implement my management philosophy about making sure that they train their subordinates and ensure that their people have the resources they need. And all that has got to start at the top. So, you know, my team and my executive division, that's the philosophy they operate with, and it flows down from there. And I push as much responsibility as possible down to the lowest level as possible so that the folks who are doing the day-to-day work have the flexibility to make the decisions they need to make to move cases, to make sure justice gets done in each and every case, and that they know the work they're doing matters.
You know, that's a great point, I think, just to stop for a second on. Having been a deputy county attorney when I started my career as well, I found in those days, and we're going back a long time, but in those days, it wasn't like that. You know, the line guys that were in the trial bureau, like myself, were very much micromanaged to the point where we really had very little discretion in those days, in my judgment, okay, to make a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're saying that's eased up a little bit over the years to where, you know, when you have good people, you give them some discretion then.
Well, I think so, in particular when we're talking about young attorneys. They're prosecutors for a reason. That's something that they felt called to do. Because you're not going to get rich doing it.
Right.
So if that's what they want to do, and I'm going to give them the training to perform those job duties and tasks, then I need to give them the freedom to do it. And if I micromanage everything, now that's not to say that we don't have policies.
Of course.
And we want to make sure that defendants who commit similar crimes and are similarly situated receive similar outcomes.
Yeah.
And that's how you have to do it within a large office like we have. But I hate to be micromanaged.
Yeah.
Well,
I think to keep people better. I mean, one of the things about the county attorney's office, always had a high turnover because a lot of people got their experience and would leave. But that's always a challenge there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're making it into an environment where people are enjoying it more to where they're not looking to just jump out, right?
Right. And we've got the challenge in the economic environment that we do have. But aside from that, then, one of the best things that I can do, if we're not just talking about compensation, is to create a work environment in which people understand that they have the opportunity to make a difference. They can apply their talents and skills that they bring with them to the job and make a difference in what it is that they're doing. And I think that's a responsibility that I have as a manager, a CEO, if you will, of a large law firm, to create that kind of an environment.
All right, well, we're talking with Bill Montgomery, the county attorney in Maricopa County, about his job and what he's doing. And we're going to come back and talk more, Bill, about some of the philosophy that you have put into effect that's different than some of your predecessors, okay?
All right.
All right, we'll be back after these commercial messages.
I try to sleep, they're wide awake, they won't let me alone.
All right, well, this is Dennis Wolchek, Jack Wolchek, and we are here with County Attorney Bill Montgomery. Always a pleasure to have Bill talk with us. He's a great guy, former military commander, and now commanding the county attorney's office. And I have to say, doing a great job of it and bringing and restoring back to the office what should be there, which is the respect of our citizenry. and from a tumultuous period of time, as we all know. But, Bill, we were talking before the break really about how you run your office, and I know we have a lot of topics to hit, but I just wanted to come back to that briefly. In terms of your philosophy, you were saying, and how you imbue some of the younger attorneys with your feeling about how things should go, and then try to give them at least a little bit of leeway so that, you know, they don't feel like they're just potted plants. So
right.
Tell us a little bit more about that, and then we'll go on to something else.
Sure. Well, I think the best way to illustrate that, too, is from the beginning when new prosecutors come into the office, because we have been able to hire to replace some of the positions that that folks have left to go on to other economic opportunities. But when they come in now, we've gone back to where we do have a much more rigorous new employee orientation program and new training program for prosecutors. I can't ask them to exercise the degree of discretion they're going to have to exercise to be successful if I don't give them the tools to do it. And then I meet with every new training class of prosecutors to share with them what I believe the role of a prosecutor is, how I approached the job.
That's
when
great.
I did it. For, you know, I was a line prosecutor for over 5 years. And so I share with them exactly what my expectations are. I look each one of them in the eye and say, here's what your role is. You've got the freedom to make mistakes. Do not let yourself get in a situation where you feel your professionalism, your personal honor and integrity is going to be compromised because you didn't ask questions. I have an open door policy. I encourage them to come see me if they think that guidance they're receiving differs from what they're hearing from me directly. So we emphasize that. We make sure they get the right tools to be able to operate well. And we've also started management training for first-line supervisors. So, again, we're creating that best environment for that to occur.
Yeah, and again, when I was at the office many years ago, none of that was in place. It was just kind of like they threw you into justice court and you kind of either sank or swam, and that was the most training you got. And, frankly, other than the fact that I knew him personally, you never met the county attorney ever. The only time, even in the office, that I ever met the county attorney the time I was there, we had a dart tournament, and I just happened to be pitted up against him. That was the only time I ever saw him. And once when he came through the trial bureau with one of the board of supervisors and just said hello to people, you know, and that was it. I mean, so it was a whole different philosophy.
Yeah, and I try to get out. I will get out more. When I was the first year of my last term, I did get out. I went to each of the different bureau meetings, wanted to bump into folks.
It's hard. I mean, obviously, it's hard.
Yeah, the campaign season restricts that a bit.
Yeah, I know. It's tough, but just getting out there a little bit is a good thing. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about before I forget is we read your name in the papers a couple of weeks ago, as I was saying off the air, and I was kind of surprised, and that's why it stuck with me, that you were personally arguing something in front of the Ninth Circuit. Why don't you tell our listening audience about that and why you personally were handling it, because I thought that was rather unusual. I don't remember. Certainly our former county attorneys weren't either capable of it or didn't do it, that's for sure. But you're a working lawyer. I mean, you actually went in front of the Ninth Circuit and argued.
I did, and it was because I handled the case at the district court level as well, and it had to deal with defending Arizona's 20-week abortion statute. Now, my involvement in that initially was because I was named as a defendant.
You personally?
Correct.
Oh.
Correct, as the county attorney.
Okay.
The plaintiffs in the case, some abortion doctors here, named the attorney general by name in his official capacity, me in my official capacity, the Pima County attorney, and then our medical exam review board and their executive director.
So, just so we understand, what was the issue teed up? I mean, why are they suing you personally?
Well, they sued me because there's a criminal provision within the statute that if a doctor performs an abortion after 20 weeks, except for the health or welfare of the mother, that they can be charged with a Class 1 misdemeanor. Okay, it's a criminal offense, so they charged, or they didn't charge, they named some of the larger prosecution agencies in the state.
But, I mean, what was the basis of the suit? Charge the doctors with anything?
Oh, no, it was
like a declaratory relief or something?
Well, they were seeking a preliminary injunction in order to prevent the law from going into effect.
I see.
So that was sort of why they were bringing the suit in the first place. And we were short on civil attorneys. My office is working hard, and the civil side of the office provides legal advice and representation to county agencies and officials, and we work very hard at it. And when the case was coming up, I sat down with my civil services division chief, and he was saying that, look, you know, here's who we have available, but their ability to prepare for this is not going to be as great as it could be if you could take the time to do it. And I like being an attorney. I like to think that I still have enough of a brain left where I can think like an attorney, and I haven't been too jaded by being a politician. And so I took on the challenge. I prepared for that argument in district court. We were successful there. It was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. At that point, it did not make any sense, and it would have been inefficient. It would not have been a good use of resources just to get another deputy county attorney up to speed to make the argument at the appellate level. Was there some degree of personal political risk? I guess so. But I'm someone who is going to prepare for the case anyway, and I didn't see it in political terms as much as I saw it as I'm also an attorney, and I handled it at the district court level, and so me going to make that argument in front of the Ninth Circuit panel was a continuation of the representation I'd begun.
Now, that was a pretty truncated proceeding, wasn't it? I mean, it was a very quick proceeding. You got up from the district court to the Court of Appeals pretty quickly, didn't you?
We did. It was just, I think, a few months. The briefing schedule was pretty accelerated. But now, we had, I didn't mind it being that accelerated either, although the plaintiffs in the case asked for an extension to be able to address additional amicus briefs that had been filed. But it was still rather quick. And I'm okay with that. At this point now, we're waiting for the decision to come down, regardless of what happens there.
Well, one of the things I remember, if I'm not mistaken, was I saw you on TV, if I'm recalling this correctly, and I thought you were saying that you weren't sure how it was going to go, if I'm not mistaken. That's what I recall of it. Is that accurate, or am I misremembering that?
I'm an eternal optimist, so... I'll say that
when it comes to Ninth Circuit, I am not. I will say that on the record.
I don't know how they're going to rule until they rule, but I'll just say that the kindest.
Who's the panel, by the way?
We had Judge Schroeder, Judge Berzon, and Judge Kleinfeld. And the kindest thing any one of the three said was Judge Kleinfeld when he told me that I may be intuiting where the law is going, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Just knowing the history of that panel, I thought Schroeder was already gone. I thought she had already retired or something, but. Knowing the history of that panel, I think you got some challenges there.
Oh, and they were evident from the beginning.
Yeah, okay. So in other words, you got that feeling from the hearing itself. It wasn't
Yeah.
Of course, you never know. You never know. But anyway, but that was great because, as I was saying off the air too, having just seen that movie Lincoln, I've been doing a little reading about him. And, in fact, when I left the house this morning, my wife got a huge picture, like about a 4-foot picture of Abraham Lincoln, like a photograph that was taken in during the campaign. An 1860 campaign, but as I said, you're going to see the movie. I know,
right?
But it just leaves you with a great feeling about the country and about somebody that you can still admire and look up to in this crazy time, and a politician that was really above the fray. He really did what he thought was right for all the right reasons, and that's a truly inspiring thing. But anyway, reason I brought that up was because he was a practicing lawyer. I mean, he, right up until the presidency, he was trying cases, and a lot of them, and in court all the time. And so I like to see that, not to excess, because I think, you got a lot of administrative things to do, and sometimes it's distracting if you do it too much.
Right, and to prepare for an argument like that, to be competent in the representation, it takes a lot of preparation.
A lot of time.
And, I'd love to be able to carry a caseload. What I loved most about being a prosecutor was being able to be in trial. And I can't do that anymore because it takes me away from all the other duties associated with
sad.
The office.
When I was there, Chuck Hyder, who was the county attorney then, who had been the chief deputy before then, but Chuck actually did try cases. I went actually to watch him try cases while he was county attorney. It was a wonderful thing to see. But that was just in his blood, now he's the U.S. attorney. But he loved that. I mean, he loved getting out of the office and doing that. So, maybe once in a while it would be a good thing for you to take a select case.
I'd love to try and do it.
Yeah, it'd be cool. Now, when you were a county attorney, deputy county attorney, I should say, what kinds of cases did you handle? What bureau were you in and what area?
Sure. I started off out in the Mesa office, and I handled vehicular crimes cases, so felony DUIs all the way up to vehicular aggravated assaults and manslaughters. And then I slid over and started working on gang cases and repeat offenders. And then left the office in 04, came back mid-08, and picked up where I left off, handling repeat offenders, those who are committing multiple felonies. And then came downtown and took over the Auto Theft Bureau and supervised and then handled a number of auto theft-related cases.
That. And when you left, where did you go, to private practice?
I went to private practice with an insurance defense firm, Lewis Brisbois.
Right.
Great folks there. Practiced for a while. My mother took ill with lung cancer, and so I left and cared for her for a while until she passed away in 2005, and then wound up running for attorney general.
I remember that, yeah.
And was a Republican nominee. Did that for a while, did some victims' rights advocacy work. So I appeared in both state and federal courts at the trial and appellate level for victims of crime, and then went back to Lewis Brisbois for a while. My father took ill with lung cancer, and I joked with the managing partner there that my family won't let me come back.
Yes.
They're afraid who might get sick the next time I do.
Yeah, exactly. Scary.
And then that was the interim between my two stints at the county attorney's office.
Interesting, yeah. Well, we're going to take our break in just, I think, about a minute. But I wanted to get into some of these areas that your office is now spearheading. You know, for example, the medical marijuana issue.
Yes.
Big, hot issue. Before we break, if you can, we maybe get cut off in about a minute. But tell us just briefly where your office stands on that issue now, where we are, in fact, period, on the issue.
Sure. Well, we had argument in front of Judge Gordon a couple of weeks ago as well, arguing that because of the Controlled Substances Act at the federal level, Arizona's efforts to try to reschedule or basically reclassify marijuana as a medicine are preempted by federal law, which leaves me with state law to enforce that prohibits possession, cultivation, and distribution and sale of marijuana. So we're trying to get clarification because we're right now in this sort of nether region where Arizona is trying to say something federal law prohibits.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that. It's a fascinating topic. I think we've talked about it before on the show. So anyway, we'll be back after the news break. This is Dennis and Jack Wolinchek with County Attorney Bill Montgomery. Legalese with Jack Wolinchek by my side, my trusty sidekick, and Bill Montgomery, you know, county attorney in Maricopa County, and a huge job. And, Bill, you know, first of all, I want to thank you for being here again because I know that everybody's running out to, you know, get an early break on the holiday, and here you are doing
what
the people's
work. What
better
way to begin the Thanksgiving weekend?
I agree. And thank you is what we should say. All right. Well, we were talking about this cannabis legislation, litigation that's going on. And I think there's nobody that can describe what's going on better than you can and put it into a little synopsis for our listening audience. It's confusing for the average person to know what's going on with this. And I think you can explain to them where we are on this.
Sure. Well, and at the forefront, too, part of the argument for those who are advocates for medicinal use of marijuana want to argue that the citizens passed this. So we've got the will of the voters being expressed. There was a majority of people who voted in favor of it. But the problem is that we as citizens in retaining the power of initiative and referendum have no more ability to pass something that's unconstitutional than the legislature does.
Right.
And then you want to ask, well, why is it unconstitutional? It's because we have federal law that says that you can't possess, use, cultivate, grow, or distribute marijuana. So Arizona can't pass a law and says, well, as a matter of fact, you can, and we're going to facilitate you in doing it. That's where the conflict comes. If there's a conflict between state and federal law, then the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution says federal law is supreme.
All right, but stop right there before you go on, because that's what I was asking earlier. Isn't that really contrary to what Arizona argues in a lot of these cases?
Well, in the Supremacy Clause and preemption, sure. We argued in the arena of SB 1070 and some of our immigration enforcement laws that they weren't preempted by the federal government. But the consistent position in each of those areas, whether it's immigration or it's with respect to marijuana, is we just want the federal laws enforced. In the immigration arena, we were trying to do things at the state level because the federal government was not enforcing the law. In the arena of marijuana,
good distinction.
Yeah, we're saying, okay, we want those laws enforced too, unless the federal government's going to change.
So that's the consistency. Okay, well, anyway, I interrupted you, but so where are we now on this?
Well, we had argument at the trial court level several weeks ago in front of Judge Gordon. He did not give an indication on when he was going to issue his ruling because he was very sensitive to the fact that this is a statewide issue, and so he wanted to be very careful about addressing the issues. I think we might get a ruling before the end of the year. Obviously, the sooner the better before any other dispensaries are issued an operating certificate and go into operation, because if they do in Maricopa County and a Maricopa County law enforcement agency submits a case on the sale or distribution of marijuana, I'll review it for prosecution.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough situation. But on that point, just logically, why wouldn't the federal government be the one pursuing that violation? Why would you be pursuing it?
Well, if it happens within Maricopa County, and again, enforcing state law,
right?
Because we do have an attorney general's opinion that did declare, for the weight that it has, that possession, cultivation, and distribution of marijuana is, in fact, preempted by federal law. that being the case, then Arizona statutes 13-3405, state law, says you can't do those things.
Okay.
So to be clear, too, I'm not enforcing federal law here. I'm enforcing state law. Citizens' efforts through the initiative to establish exemptions to prosecution,
right,
because they're preempted by federal law are invalid, leaving me with state law to enforce.
All right. So you're saying, if I understood you, I may have misunderstood you, that assuming that Judge Gordon rules that these dispensaries cannot exist, for the reasons you've articulated, then you would be in a position to prosecute.
Certainly then. I think I'm in a position to prosecute now.
Even if he rules otherwise?
Well, if he were to rule otherwise, good distinction. Good distinction. If Judge Gordon were to rule that there is no preemption issue and that the proposition can be given full force and effect, then I don't have jurisdiction.
Okay.
Nothing for me to do. I shut up.
Right.
Now, depending on how he rules, we might appeal it, but that then would certainly foreclose any current activity on my part.
But then I guess what's still confusing to me is, and probably to most of my listeners, if that were to happen, then again, you're saying that it's still a violation of federal law, right?
Is my best reading of the initiative and the Controlled Substances Act correct?
Yeah.
Even if people were engaged in that, it would still be a violation of federal
law. Right. Now, if the federal government chooses not, you're not there to enforce federal law. So,
no, I can't.
Right. So if the federal government chooses then, I guess, to do something about it, but it seems like they're probably not doing so from what I can see around the country so far.
They're not with respect to personal use or possession.
Yeah, yeah.
But they have taken action in a number of states, most notably in California, where all four U.S. attorneys have issued similar letters to property owners telling them that they can have their property seized and their rents and leases confiscated and forfeited if they're permitting their property to be used for marijuana distribution or cultivation.
Right, but they're actually not doing anything much about it other than threatening to do something about it. I haven't seen anything where they've done anything about it.
Well, I think that's because most of those businesses, once they get those letters, are shutting down.
Okay.
They're not putting the federal government to the test.
Yeah, okay. Well, that makes some sense. So anyway, you're waiting on this ruling, and that's where you are right now.
Correct.
So nobody's opening up pot dispensaries, although there's one that I saw that opened up on the west side of town.
There's one that's been given an operating certificate in Glendale. It actually has not opened yet.
Oh, but I was curious about that while we're on that. Do you know anything about that? Why would that be an exception?
It's not.
Yeah,
It's curious why DHS would have gone ahead and done that at this point in time. With the Attorney General's opinion, with pending legal action, with clear federal law.
And why one as opposed to any other ones? I didn't quite understand that.
Well, part of them getting an operating certificate for any dispensary, there has to be a state inspection.
Right.
There are specific rules that were promulgated by DHS that a dispensary has to follow in order to qualify to open up.
So maybe they took that risk and.
Yeah, and I think it's the case that other dispensaries who may have received an initial license and still need to get their operator certificate are still working on complying with all those rules.
And probably don't want to do that until they're sure. They probably don't want to make the investment until they're sure where this is going.
And I think that's a smart move.
Right, and even the one that did open up, again, according to you, is still subject potentially to the U.S. attorney in Arizona saying, watch out.
Oh, correct, regardless
of what you do, yeah. It's a wild area, it really is. All right, well, let's talk about some other areas you've been working on. You worked on the Fiesta Bowl probe and lobbying reform issues. Is that sort of coming to an end, or to the extent you can talk about it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, the investigation itself was concluded in December of this year. Or no, December of last year we wrapped it up. And what we wound up doing after that was issuing a set of recommendations on changes to the law that would bring the law into, I'll call it, compliance with the public's expectations about gift reporting, disclosure, and what we expect from elected officials and lobbyists. The last session didn't take up any of those reforms, but I know that a lot of them are being considered again this session in light of other campaign finance reforms that are being discussed and some initiative reforms.
All right, let's talk, and I'm going to hit some topics with you just because the time runs out, as you can see. The return of the civil litigation functions, that's now completed. You're actually now, once again, a complete county attorney's office, opposed to half a county attorney's office?
Right. Well, as part of the troubles in the past, the civil litigation functions were taken away from the county attorney's office through some budget moves, and litigation units were set up within county management. Within the first 5 months of me taking office right away, we were able to get those functions returned so that the county attorney's office could both statutorily and constitutionally exercise all the duties and functions of the office. And we were able to do it without any additional contested litigation.
That's fantastic. Now let's talk real quickly. We probably have about a minute left, but human smuggling, are you pursuing those cases?
We are. We are. Last year alone, there were over 400 cases involving coyotes and their clients. And Dennis, as long as we have an unsecured southern border, and Maricopa County is a destination county for human and drug smuggling, I'm going to continue to do that.
Well, let me ask you real quick, and this is an obvious question that people want to know. I mean, the sheriff sort of, I don't know where he is at this point. We're going to have him on the show again, I'm sure. But he's sort of taking this nice guy stance now, it looks like, where he's not really wanting to enforce things anymore or wants to make friends with everybody, which is maybe a good thing. Who knows? But the point is, the relationship that he had with Andrew Thomas, obviously a little different with you, no doubt. But are you guys still – is that a priority right now?
Well, it is. We're the only county in the state that's enforcing the law in that way. And again, because we're a destination county for that criminal activity, we need to. And I just to be clear, too, for folks, I don't think the sheriff would say he's backing off of enforcement. I think what he's saying is that he understands that in communicating why he's doing what he's doing and
okay,
the need
that's
for
fair.
It, less rhetoric – More explanation about
okay.
professional
needs. That's well said. Okay, well, we'll be coming back with Bill Montgomery, county attorney, on the eve of Thanksgiving. He's nice enough to spend his time with us, and we'll be back after these commercial messages.
I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, this is Dennis Molinchek and Jack Molinchek, and we are back. No lawyers. Oh, we've got a couple of lawyers in the room, but no guns or money, I hope. Certainly no money on my part. But anyway, and no guns on your part. But, you know, Bill, we have Bill Montgomery, county attorney, who, again, is nice enough to appear and to talk about his office with us. And it's really a pleasure because a lot of people don't know a lot about the office, quite frankly. And it's an extremely powerful office, but people just don't know how it works. So having you once in a while give us an understanding of that is very helpful. we're talking, about some of the priorities in the office. Now that you've been reelected, we were talking about human smuggling. We just got into that, so that's still a priority, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. And what else in terms of immigration? Is that off the agenda beyond the human smuggling part, or is it seems to have waned in popularity or something?
Well, and just because there's not a lot of rhetoric continuing over the issue, or we're not seeing people marching the street, which is a whole other different component of the immigration debate as a whole. What we have done within the county attorney's office is basically maintain a law and order approach towards the full and fair enforcement of our laws addressing the criminal impact of illegal immigration. And unless and until the federal government does its job and steps into the enforcement gap, Arizona is left in a position where, and we now know how far we can go as a state to engage in enforcement of laws addressing illegal immigration. Until the immigration issue is resolved, until that border is secure, we're going to continue to have the criminal environment that illegal immigration contributes to. So I would be remiss and be violating my oath of office if I did not continue to prosecute the cases that are brought to me.
Well, I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, you've got to feel some of the pressure of the demonstrations and so forth, such as the kind the sheriff receives. They don't do that with you quite the way they do with him. But it's a tough situation. You're trying to enforce the law. On the other hand, people personalize it as if it's something that you're out to get them or something.
In that regard, too, once I took office, I engaged in a very concerted effort to communicate with the Hispanic community, make sure that they understood that I didn't see this as a racial issue or an ethnic issue, because Maricopa County, we're 4 million people.
Sure.
And I'm not going to allow parts of our community to be balkanized where then criminals might think they can go into an area because of someone's potential immigration status and they can victimize them. So from the outset, I wanted to make sure that folks understood that if you're a victim of a crime or a witness to a crime, your immigration status is a second, third, fourth level of concern to me. I want to go after the offender. And so I've been working with them from the outset, partnering with different aspects of the Hispanic community and throughout Maricopa County on crime-fighting initiatives. And part of that does require me to enforce, again, those laws that address the criminal impact of illegal immigration. Human smuggling is one. Legal Arizona Workers Act is another. And so we're going to continue to do that. I believe it's my obligation. And you know, Dennis, there's a human rights component too. If we can deter human smuggling activity here in Maricopa County, then that necessarily should contribute to a reduction in the number of people who die each summer in the Sonoran Desert trying to cross the border in 115-degree heat.
You know, while we're on that, you know, we were just laughing off the air. I mean, I argue that human smuggling. I actually never got to argue it. That's a long story, I was saying, where Judge Kaczynski basically told me to sit down because I wasn't answering one of the judge's questions. But anyway, where is that legally now?
Well, we've been enforcing it. As I'm sure you're aware, a state court ruled at the appellate level that it was constitutional to apply
right.
our conspiracy statute to violations of the human smuggling law. And that makes sense. You can have a conspiracy to purchase narcotics even if you're the person who's going to use it. So if you're the coyote or you're the client who hired the coyote for the human smuggling services, you're engaging in a violation of that statute. I do know that it's still working its way through federal courts where they're trying to argue that federal immigration law preempts this. And again, to be consistent, wanting all laws enforced, I don't think that's correct. We're dealing with a state criminal statute and a state conspiracy statute. So
but it's still kicking around.
It is. It hasn't gone away.
Well, yeah. I mean, just quickly, I remember Judge Kaczynski in that argument asking the attorneys about whether if somebody got in a taxi cab, it was illegal. Would the taxi cab driver be prosecuted? You know, that kind of question. It's kind of. Went from the sublime to the ridiculous, you know.
And I would say it depends on his knowledge and his criminal
intent. Right, right, that's true. But generally, no, the answer was.
Correct.
We're not going to blame him. But anyway, all right, let's talk about some of the other reforms and things that you're doing in your office. There's a sentencing reform study. What is that all about?
Well, a couple of years ago when I took office, there was this sentence reform effort that was underway in Arizona. And I kept asking the question, what are we trying to reform? So the Arizona Prosecuting Attorneys Advisory Council in 2009 had commissioned a study that basically was a demographic study of who we have in Arizona's prisons. Revealed that 94.9% of people who were in Arizona's prisons were there for a violent offense or a repeat felony. And roughly 5% or so were there for as so-called nonviolent first-time offenders.
Hmm.
And the reality is, even those nonviolent first-time offenders, 63% of those were drug traffickers.
Right.
And the remainder, they were sentenced as first-time offenders, but that was because of a plea agreement. They really weren't first-time offenders. If you looked at their criminal history, they had
multiple offenders. It's actually interesting to hear those statistics. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. So fast forward then a couple of years later, and we asked for an update to that. There's a 350-page report
mm-hmm.
that you can find at azsentencing.org that lays out who's in our prisons right now, what has been the impact of truth in sentencing on crime, and what are some of the other longitudinal impacts of 85% truth in sentencing, of mandatory sentencing, and recidivism?
So how has that statistic changed over the years?
Well, from 2009 to 2011, the number of prisoners in Arizona's prisons who are there for a violent offense or repeat felony has gone up. We're now over 95%, and so we're still looking at over 60% of the so-called nonviolent offenders or drug traffickers. We still have that problem, but the sentencing reform effort tried to make the argument that we had too many nonviolent first-time drug offenders in prison, and that's just it's false.
It's false what you're saying. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's absolutely false. And in reality, people who are in prison solely for a drug possession offense, it's less than 100 people.
Hmm.
And the other thing, too, that we saw about the same time is that Arizona's prison population has been dropping for the last 18 months. On average, we have more people leaving prison than going in for the first time in Arizona's history. At the same time, crime in Maricopa County has been falling. For about the last 10 years, our crime rate has been about the drop in crime has been almost double what it has been nationally.
Wow.
So when you look at it, over 95% of the people in Arizona's prisons are there for violent offenses or repeat felonies.
So what about these drug offenders and so forth? Where are they going?
Well, what we're doing with them is we're offering them substance abuse treatment.
Okay.
And we're diverting
That's actually
them.
Very good to hear. I'm really pleased to hear that.
Yeah, and the historical trending for those programs shows that for one in particular, Maricopa County, we've had about a 75% success rate where they're completing the program. They're not getting in trouble again.
Yeah, well, not just locking them up.
No, and yeah. That's a win-win for us. What we'll see is if somebody's going to engage in substance abuse and they're a career criminal, then they're going to go on, they're going to commit other crimes, and we know how to deal with those.
Okay.
But if you got someone who truly has a substance abuse issue and that's the extent of their criminal activity, we're going to give them a chance to get cleaned up.
Great.
And if they do it, great. If they don't, again, we know what to do with them.
No, that's good. Now, what is, turning to another area, what is life means life legislation? What's that all about?
Sure. Well, up until the most recent legislative session, if you were an adult premeditated first-degree murderer, you had three sentencing options. The death penalty,
right.
Natural life, or life with the possibility of parole after 25 years. Well, that last sentencing option really runs counter to the promise to victims of crime in Arizona's Constitution that after a conviction and a sentence, the case is done. But if you had your loved one taken by an adult murderer, 25 years later, you could find yourself in front of a commutation board having to make an argument why that person should stay in prison. And then depending upon their classification, you may come back the next year and the next year and the next year and so on. So what you thought was concluded and final, 25 years later, you now get to relive that hell.
Yeah.
Well, that's not following through on what we promised people in our Constitution. So we took away that sentencing option. So if you're an adult premeditated first-degree murderer, the only two sentences...
So you championed this up in the legislature.
Correct.
Yeah. So now what you're saying, basically, we've got only about 2 minutes. That's why I'm...
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. We'll have you on again, I promise.
Okay.
But life means... That's a great idea. I mean, I was not aware of this. So what you're saying is you championed this concept that, hey, when we say life, we mean it.
Right.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Truth in advertising.
All right. Let me ask you this, and I just only have a couple of minutes, Bill. I'm sorry. I told you to go so quickly. Tell us in your next term... I asked you this last time, but tell us in your next term what... This term, really. What your... main priority and focus is going to be?
Sure. Some of the main priorities are going to be continued reform of our child welfare system that we began with the Child Safety Task Force the governor formed last year. And then we want to continue to improve the professionalism within the office. And we want the office to become a 21st century prosecution agency. So we've got a 3-year information technology plan to create greater efficiencies for prosecutors and everybody. And we want the county attorney's office, as the third largest prosecution agency in the country, to set the standard.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Bill, sorry. We'll have you on again. There's so much to talk about.
Thank you, Dennis.
We're just touching on some of these things, and we want to get more detail. But, folks, that was Bill Montgomery, our county attorney in Maricopa County, a great guy and someone that you voted for properly as our county attorney for the next 4 years. And we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk with Bill over then. And thanks again for coming before the Thanksgiving holiday.
Thank you, Dennis. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, same to you. And, Jack, take care. You got to stop asking all those
I'll
questions.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
and silent Jack over here. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. All right, guys. We'll see you. Take care.